So hi, everybody. My name's Rebecca Coffey. I'm a science journalist. I'm also a humorist and a novelist. And I'm on Stephanie's Dope Science Show, talking real science and real lust. And the name of the book is Science and Lust.
Hello, welcome to the Dope Science Show with Stephanie Lowe, a.k.a. Science Steph with Steph. Thank you for your ears and minds. I hope that the show sparks new ideas, new opportunities, and conversations. I want us to learn and grow. We are all curious, innovative, and experimental in our daily lives. We are all dope scientists.
Hello, you guys. Thank you so much for checking in on the show, the Dope Science Show. This is Stephanie, a.k.a. Science Stuff with Steph, and I am so pleased to have a really interesting guest on the show. Her name is Rebecca Coffey, and she is a science journalist and published author. Hello, Rebecca. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me, Stephanie.
Yes, I was really happy to hear from your publicist. Because I'm always interested in, I have a background in cultural anthropology, but I also study like biological anthropology. And so I tend to have an interest towards evolution, biological evolution, and all the different theories of culture and how we've evolved. And I'm always interested in talking about sex and science too. So it's perfect.
Yes, perfect.
For the audience, Rebecca Coffey is the author of a very interesting book that I think you guys would love to check out. It's called Science and Lust. Is that what the title is again?
Yes, it is. Yes.
Very simple, easy to remember, Science and Lust. And before we get into it, like, I always like to give my audience just a snapshot of who we're talking to. The humanity of who our guests are. So one of the cool things I've started doing is I try to find out a little bit, like, what are your likes? For one of the questions I ask you is, what is your favorite movie?
And it has always been The Wizard of Oz. Ever since I was a little girl, they would broadcast it once a year. And it was a family event. And then when I got into college and started watching it with my friends, I started to really notice how bizarre it is in parts, how bizarre all of the munchkins are. And I got that second layer of kind of adult humor. Mm-hmm. And my allegiance to the movie has never wavered since.
Because it's like, the older you got, the more you appreciated the movie, actually.
Because I could see it on several different levels. First of all, I was studying drama. I was in a drama conservatory studying to be a director. And so I was very interested in how you take all of the pieces of a production. How, you know, the music, the sound effects, the, you know, the casting, the scenery. And so when I watched the movie, I could see that certain backgrounds were painted and certain backgrounds weren't. I could catch the mistakes in the costuming. It, you know, so I was seeing it as an adult and as a child at the same time.
It's a masterpiece. I really enjoy the movie too, but I will admit, when I was a kid, I found it scary. I thought it was like, even though it was like a family movie, the chaos of being of the Dorothy experience and just like the oppression and just like I found it like the witch to be very scary. Like I never found it to be very lighthearted. It was a scary story, and I was so relieved, you know, when she makes it out at the end.
And did the flying monkeys particularly upset you?
Yes, they were super scary. The flying monkeys, just because, you know, the whole chaotic energy and the feeling of not knowing what they're going to do because you can't predict their behavior, like that scared me as a kid.
Yeah, yeah. Well, most people that I talk to are terrified by the monkeys.
But it's great. I feel like some of the best stories are twisted like that, you know?
Right. And I think that scary stories serve a purpose for children, because if they come out with the child conquering, then maybe the child is a little bit emboldened in the face of the scary things in their lives.
Yeah, I think so, because you can look back on it. I'm trying to think of any lessons. I do definitely think scary stories help me be better behaved.
Yeah, I think that may be what the Brothers Grimm had in mind all the time when they were writing, that they were just making good little boys and girls.
It works. Those stories definitely did. And you know what else was super scary? I love Wizard of Oz, but in the same frame of thought, Alice in Wonderland is just like on the same like thing for me, where I'm like, oh my gosh, like this alternative world where you're kind of lost in it and you have to live by the rules of it. And it's, you know, doesn't seem to make sense.
So did even the Disney movie scare you?
The cartoon version?
Yeah.
Of the Wizard of Alice in Wonderland?
Yes.
No, I found it very interesting. I didn't find that scary. I did find the Cheshire Cat. Is that how you say
yes.
it?
Cheshire? Cheshire Cat, yeah.
I found him to be very just disheartening and uncomfortable, as well as the caterpillar.
Okay, that's interesting. All right. No, I guess nothing scared me as a kid.
Nothing?
No, nothing. And I don't know why. I was
brave.
Well, I was surrounded by siblings. And so maybe it was that I was always just in a large pack of kids, most of whom were older than I was. So I figured if they could tolerate it, I could tolerate it.
Yeah, that makes sense. I was like the oldest out of a pack of kids, and I was born like nervous. So I was just already set up.
Well, you know, my daughter was terrified. She was terrified of Sesame Street. Like, chairs would talk, and she would start screaming, "Chairs don't talk." And so it was very... She wanted to be, you know, like normal, like the other kids, and be able to watch Sesame Street. And she wanted to be able to watch movies. And so I rented Bambi. And I used to be a video producer. And so I still had editing equipment. And I knew she would not be able to tolerate Bambi's mother dying. And so I edited that out. It just never happened.
What?
And when she was 12, I took her and her little brother aside and I said, "Listen, I have to tell you something about Bambi's mom." And I broke the news to them that she dies in the movie.
Wow.
They were old enough to handle it.
Yeah. I remember watching that when I was little and I cried when Bambi's mom died. I found it very shocking. I was just like, no, it was one of the only movies as a kid where you saw tragedy happen to the kids, you know, where it wasn't like, oh, everything's going to be okay.
But Dumbo was the same way. Dumbo, you saw the mother and the baby separated and the baby terrified and the mother humiliated and beaten. And it, I found that as an adult, I found it really disturbing. Just a disturbing set of choices for a bunch of animators to have made.
Yeah, you know what? I wonder. I don't think there's anything wrong with like kids watching that content, but at the time, like, you know how you mentioned you'd watch it with your whole family. I feel like a lot of the early movies and cartoons were, you know, always, well, some of them were more geared towards adults than children, and then it became more blended, like a mixed audience. So it's like they wanted to tell deep stories and presented in such a way that it, you know, you can still show it to kids, you know?
Right. Right.
Yeah. And I don't think that's inherently wrong, but it does make it a little bit hard when you're an older with those adult eyes to be like, oh my gosh,
yes,
we're showing this to children.
Right.
You know? But hey, that's life. You know, you can't escape all the human behaviors and things like that. And it's just who we are.
Yes,
And,
and I, as a mother, probably should never have edited the Bambi, the Bambi movie. I should just have, talked them through that what was about to happen and then helped them understand what had happened. But no, I chickened out and I edited the scene.
it was because you're a mom and you're like probably just trying to keep them in that nice bubble a little bit longer, you
Right.
know?
Right.
We have those feelings, like the people who, when people tell their kids, oh yeah, there's Santa Claus, and they try to protect that lie for as long as they can,
Yeah.
you know. But I don't know. It's we just want to protect them, so can't be too hard on ourselves, you know.
And do you have children?
Yes, I have a one child. She's 12, and I did let her believe in Santa Claus for a little while, but I couldn't protect her from the world. She found out pretty quickly, I think, by the time she was like 4 or 5, maybe 5 or something.
And I told my daughter, because she was the first one, right off the bat, there is no such thing as Santa Claus. I can't lie to you. It's a way that adults manipulate their children to be good for a few weeks. And then she went to somebody's third birthday party and Santa Claus came. And Katie turned to me and said, Mom, you were wrong.
Oh.
And so I just like, okay, well, I gave you the information. I'm not the one lying to you. And I just let her believe whatever she wanted.
Oh, that's cool. See, my daughter, she found out because we're watching The Simpsons, and they outed Santa in the episode, and I
No.
didn't see it coming. I was like, no, turn, oh. I was like, what? But years later, or not even, she would purposely say, oh, this year we're believing in Santa Claus, okay? Like she was like,
Oh,
I'm
okay.
gonna believe in it. We're gonna play this game. I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
And we
Good.
just did, you know, because
Good.
she enjoyed it, you know.
Yeah.
You mentioned growing up with like a big family, and earlier I asked you before the show, like I mentioned that you're a science journalist, and I was wondering, like, how did you find that route? Like, what was your? You mentioned you were a director, you're a producer. Like, how did you become a science journalist?
Well, like any young person in New York, I had to make a living. And one way to make a living was to concentrate on science because nobody else was. Everybody else was afraid of the topic. And in my family growing up, half of the people were scientists. So we just spoke about chemistry and electricity and magnetism at the dinner table. So I wasn't afraid of it at all. So while, I was 25 years old and living in New York, and all of my friends wanted to produce music videos, for example, I knew I wasn't going to be able to get a job high up in the hierarchy working on a music video because I wasn't a musician and I wasn't a dancer. But I could get work high up in the hierarchy producing programs about science. And so I just went for it because it was something that I felt completely comfortable with. And then when I became a journalist working primarily in print, I started working for Discover Magazine. And I learned from my editor that the board of the magazine liked my work because they found it funny that I was combining humor and science. I wasn't aware of that. But everybody in my family is funny. My brother Dan is Dr. Science, who for years had an ongoing radio show that was broadcast on most NPR stations called Ask Dr. Science. And so somebody would ask him a question and he would give a ridiculous answer. I remember one of the questions was when the spaceship you know, these are call-in questions. He doesn't know what's about to happen. When a spaceship is traveling at the speed of light, do the headlights work? And so, you know, he'd come up with something. He would just improvise something. So, and my sister, who's a year older than I, back in the 70s, was a performance artist in San Francisco. And one time I was taking care of her two-year-old for her while she performed. So I had the little boy out in front of the cafe where she was entertaining. And two men ran out of the cafe gasping for breath. And I thought maybe there was some kind of fire going on inside that made them unable to breathe. And I said, what's going on? You know, nervous is my first response. And they said, we were laughing so hard that we realized we were having a breathing emergency and we've come out to calm down. And once they got their breath, they ran back in. But she was very, very funny. And my little brother is a comic juggler in Sydney. He's quite, you know, successful and famous. So I was being funny and I didn't know it. And once I realized that that was why they were assigning me so many articles, I thought, well, I'll just go ahead and be funny.
Well, then, that's your natural self. That is great. You just kind of like just did what was you.
Right. Exactly.
That's awesome. I like to think I'm funny, but my funniness is like Seinfeld funny, situational.
Right. Right.
My situational awkward, that's kind of my thing.
Yes.
Well, I did see the humor in your book, Science and Lust, and I noticed that right away. It makes it really easy to keep reading and engaging, and you're covering some real, you know, scientific topics, and it was really easy and enjoyable to read. Do you find yourself, do you feel like there's a, beyond it being your natural being to just be humorous, do you also do it with the purpose of, do you think people learn better when there's humor?
I do. And first of all, nobody is obligated to read this book, right? It's not going to be assigned in a college class. So unless it's fun, they're not going to read it. So you have to lead with what's fun. For example, in that the first essay, Do Pygmy Chimps Dream of Electric Lips?
Yeah.
I found, you know, my lead on that is about a study that was done in 1993. A sexologist in Egypt got, I think it was 75 male rats, and he put them in different types of pants. And some of them were polyester, and some of them were polycotton, and some were cotton, and some were wool. And then he made them wear them for 12 months, and he recorded how many times they had sex. And it turned out that the ones in polyester pants had sex far less than anybody else. And he decided, or he speculated, that it was the electrostatic charges happening in the pants themselves. You know how like when you wear polyester, you're always getting shocks?
Yeah.
That those shocks were killing the rats' sex drives. So I stumbled upon that, and I thought, what a fun way to start off an essay about cultural differences in cross-cultural romance and lust, because
yeah,
you can look at that and think, sure, it was the electrical charges, but it could have been the cultural differences. It could have been that even lady rats know better than to have men wearing, have sex with men wearing polyester pants, right? So that's
right.
A fun beginning to a rather serious essay. But unless you have something that's going to draw the reader in, there's no reason for them to read about cross-cultural sex and romance. They don't wake up curious about that.
That's true. People, anything, I feel like anything that gets you, anything that will make you open up the book, anything that will make you listen and learn something new, you know, I'm pretty down to try it and experiment as well with that. I want to incorporate more humor into my show as well. I haven't figured out exactly how to do it, but I'm just going to look at some other, like you mentioned, like your brother's show, Dr. Science, and different shows that have done it that made it funny, but not forced, you know, just a very natural thing.
Right.
I read that. Go ahead.
Go ahead. No, you go ahead. I was agreeing with you.
I was going to say, I read that that essay as well, because I asked you what your favorite three essays were in the book. And without going into, I'm not going to spoil it for you guys, but I do want to talk about some of the interesting points, if that's okay with you.
Yes.
Cool. So one of the things that that came to mind was, and first of all, I love the title, Do Pygmy Chimps Dream of Electric Lips? Like, what?
Thank you.
Because, you know, you can only envision, you're like, electric lips? What? Wow, okay. But one of the talking points that came up was something I think of all the time, actually, is cooperation. And, like, is society, or what we consider civilized society, is that a product of us evolving, you know, as society? Or would you think I tend to think we're de-evolving almost. I feel like almost as if the more animalistic society is the more natural, maybe even more beneficial society than where we are civilized. I know that was a roundabout question, but you did talk about that, like cooperation. Is that a sign of being civilized, or is that a product that's more animalistic?
Right. Sigmund Freud, writing way back in 1930, said that humans need help keeping their innate beastly impulses at bay. And he thought that the civilizations that we have created, all of the rules, are what do that, are what separate us from our beastly ancestors. And in 1960, so 30 years later, Desmond Morris, who's a British zoologist, he's still alive, he's very old now, suggested that Freud might be wrong about humans and about the great apes that we descended from. He thought that humans aren't self-centered and destructive by nature because the great apes aren't. And in fact, great apes live in very rule-based societies, and the punishment for breaching those rules can be very severe. But if they live according to the rules of their societies, it's a peaceful world, and it's marked by cooperation. And so what Desmond Morris suggested was that when people assume that they need all these rules and regulations in order to get by or survive, that what they really need to do is kind of draw on their inner strength and their inner ape and be cooperative. Now, mm-hmm. He did think that there is a significant difference between apes then and apes now. We speciated from chimps about 6 or 7 million years ago, but we have almost 50 million years of primate heritage before then. So humans are more animal than they are human. And back when we became humans first, the population was far less dense than it is now. There are 200,000 more of us per square inch than there were back then. And what Morris noticed was that the behaviors of people who are thought of as crazy, you know, thought disorders, people who are markedly distressed by their mental illness, are very similar to the behaviors of caged animals. So where a caged animal might bite himself, might pace back and forth, might throw his feces, might eat his feces, you see some of those same behaviors in mentally ill human beings. And so Desmond Morris's idea was that at heart, we are, you know, cooperative beings, but civilization has allowed us to proliferate to the point where living together is very, very difficult.
That makes sense. That definitely makes sense. I mean, I know it's just one of many theories, but it's worth thinking about. All you could think about, I mean, even currently, right, we have our immigrant crises, right, in the U.S. and Europe, and if, you know, and one of the major issues beyond people having political differences or, you know, nationalities and all that thing is the space. Like people, I feel like you always hear of people feeling like they don't want to be encroached upon, you know, like
right.
Whether it's not necessarily immigrant, but like, say you went from a small town, now you're a big town, you know, there's like a shift. There's a shift that you feel, you know?
I agree. Absolutely.
Huh. Very interesting. I wonder, but it doesn't seem like there's any sort of policy mindset for that. You know, when we think about mental illness and public health, there doesn't seem to be any policy that's looking at how the environment may be affecting mental health.
No, well, because the environment is largely out of our control. We keep procreating. That is our fundamental DNA imprint, is to keep procreating. It goes back to Charles Darwin and the survival of the species. Every animal and vegetable does its best to make sure that its genes survive into generation after generation after generation. And we can't stop that. And the result of that is that we are terribly crowded and we do have to defend our resources. Now, I think we can defend our resources with a whole lot more kindness than we do. But resources are getting scarce. And in typical clannish ways, we identify the members of our clan and try to exclude the other.
Mm-hmm.
That just looks right back to our great ape heritage.
Yep. Do you in your daily life, are you struck by that? Like, man, we're just animals.
Well, yes, absolutely. Particularly with the advent of the Me Too movement and the accusations against Harvey Weinstein. I've never even noticed, is it Weinstein or Weinstein? But he behaves in a very orangutan-like way. Orangutans rape. That's how they procreate. The male just overpowers the female. And with gorillas have harems. And one way that a gorilla gets someone to join his harem is to murder her children. Because biologically, females are looking for protection for their children. If they're going to have a brood, they can't be finding all the food, raising the kids, and protecting everybody from the intruders. So they're looking for healthy, strong mates that can protect their children. But in many primate species, males kill the children that aren't theirs so that there will be more resources for the children that are theirs. So if you have a child and a gorilla comes along and kills it, one of the things you may notice is, wow, and nobody could stop him. So he must be the biggest, meanest gorilla around. So next child I have is going to be his because he's going to protect it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, I think of some men and their behavior out there as orangutanish and gorilla-ish. Some men and women I think of as bonobos. Now, bonobos, lots of people don't even know that they exist.
Those are my favorite.
Yes, they look so much like chimpanzees. They're part of, they share the species called Pan. And bonobos will have sex all day, every day, pretty much with anybody. It's the females are in charge, and they fortify their charge by creating alliances with other females, and they create those alliances and maintain those alliances by having sex with each other. Men have sex happily all day. If they can't have it with a female, they don't mind. They do this thing called penis fencing, where the two men hang upside down from a tree close to each other and then bat their penises against each other until orgasm. So bonobos are not warlike at all. They're just happy and they're having guilt-free, plentiful sex. And, you know, when Al Franken got accused in the thing, I thought, oh my, that guy's a bonobo. He just thought that was okay. It wasn't okay. She was asleep. She hadn't given her permission. But if she were a bonobo, she wouldn't have minded.
I know. I felt so bad about Al Franken because I'm a big fan. And with the Me Too movement, I definitely think it's creating positive change in society, at least in American society, with making this like an open topic that we're all talking about. Yeah. At the same time, I feel like it needs to be more nuanced, right? I'm probably getting myself in trouble. Al Franken is responsible for his actions, you guys. So I'm not saying that I'm judging him as good as, you know, as he's okay or he's not. But I do think there is a sense of boundaries, and especially if people are in a joking manner or a playful manner and they're not the normal society boundaries of, say, hey, I work in a regular corporate office and I clock in 9 to 5, is not necessarily the same in every setting. You know, people are partying together and also working together. You know, this is Hollywood we're talking about. And so I think it requires, so people don't ruin their lives and have misunderstandings, is full consent. You know, you can't kiss someone who's asleep, because I'm sure she was embarrassed when she woke up. And for her, she felt violated.
I absolutely agree with that. And we are supposed to be the most cognitively developed of the primate species. So we should be able to understand the idea of boundaries. But also, you know, men are biologically programmed to spread their seed as widely as possible. They may not think that what they're trying to do when they go to a bar is impregnate people. It's unconscious. They maybe, you know, have a pocket full of condoms, but they are biologically programmed to come on to women because it doesn't matter to them. They're not, from a primate point of view, from 45 million years of primate heritage, they're not going to be the ones raising the children. So they just need to scatter seed. They have somewhere between 40 million and 1.2 billion sperm cells in each ejaculation. They're just trying to inseminate. Women, on the other hand, are not going to have more than about 450 menstrual cycles in their lives. They need to be choosy about whose sperm they accept. Furthermore, and probably much more importantly, they're going to have to raise that child. So they have a huge investment in whose sperm they accept. So that men's biological imperative is to say, please, please, please to women, or even you must. And women's biological imperative is to say, maybe. Let me think about that, right? And neither the men or the women are necessarily aware of the biology that is dictating their behavior. But women are much choosier than men. And in our society, the way it's structured, our right to say no or even wait is not always respected.
That's very true. And, you know, the way I'm a millennial and the way I was raised is you still play hard to get. You could be bold if you want to and ask a guy out, but it's definitely normal to pretend as if you're more casual than you are. And guys have the same expectations where they think, well, okay, well, I'll see if she likes me, you know, and she might have said no, but maybe she didn't really mean no. Like, I feel like there's this whole ambiguous, yes.
Ambiguity, and, yeah.
Yes. I love it when people can say the words for me. And I feel like even with flirting, like someone, well, you might think someone's flirting with you and they're not. And I feel like this next generation, my daughter's generation and up and coming, like they have, I think that needs to be a more proactive conversation when we talk about what to expect with courting and your sex life and relationships, like what consent is and to be more forthcoming, like everyone be more forthcoming instead of trying to interpret unspoken, you know, signals. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that I think falls into dating. It's totally different for the work environment. Like those should just be black and white kind of easier rules. But as far as I see online, people saying things like, and even when I've spoken to men, that they don't know when there's consent. Like, oh, is that consent? Maybe I should, you know, just very suddenly their whole world, they don't know how to live because they feel like it's not clear on who to talk to or how to talk to women.
Right.
And I saw in one of your essays, I forget which one, I think The Human Ape, you mentioned that even when they self-identify what consent is and behavior, that if you use words that are negative, like, do you think you're a rapist? Or if you've done something like that, then men would self-select, no, of course not. But if you used more descriptive language, like, have you done this? Or would you have done that? And then they would actually end up having a higher response, that they would, you know, break someone's consent. But
yes.
It was like how you phrased it, you know?
It was a 2014 paper out of the University of North Dakota. And they asked college men, this is back in 1980, they asked them whether they'd force a woman to have sexual intercourse. And 31.7% of them said yes. That they would, in a consequence-free situation, they would force a woman to have sexual intercourse. When you asked them whether they would rape a woman, only 13.6% said they would. So those college men don't understand what rape is, and they need somebody to smack them with the definition that they're going to remember.
exactly. It's, you know, I think it's just more conversations like this and the Me Too and your book and just more conversations about it so that people, not just conversations, but some consensus that consent is sexy. I've seen that before. I've that people are starting to say consent is sexy. Full consent is sexy. You know, like being clear.
Yeah. Well said.
Yeah. Definitely. I definitely agree. And especially, I'm sorry, I'm rambling, but I'm single. So I'm out there in the world. And it's like I use these apps, like the dating apps, like Tinder, OkCupid, and so on. And they're all geared for a different interaction based on the user. You know, Tinder, you swipe left or right based on like your basic instincts. Are they hot or are they not? And in OkCupid, they've merged it recently, but they at least ask questions about them and you're supposed to get some sort of match. But I do wonder, I do wish that like Uber or Lyft or something like that, they had some sort of reporting app. Like if you've been sexually assaulted or something like that, that you can report it to the app because they know who that person is, you know?
Yes.
I don't know if they have that, but I do feel like that's needed.
Well, you have an opportunity to rate your driver and to give comments.
Mm-hmm. I feel like there would be something, there should be something like that for the dating apps for sure.
Yes. Right.
Because it's scary. I've definitely been on a few Tinder dates where I felt unsafe. I didn't, you know, I felt like I didn't want to go out again. I felt like my boundaries were crossed. I felt shame. I felt anxiety about using the app, you know, exciting about dating in general. So I do think, and maybe I'll write to them. I do think it's something that should be more a part of it. We acknowledge that we have these animal behaviors, but we all have agreed. I think society has agreed, or I'm hoping that we've agreed that consent is the way it should be.
Right. Right.
In addition to that, you guys, there's a lot more lighthearted stories in here. These are all actually pretty lighthearted and funny. I just tend to take things to a darker place because that's how I think.
So one of the more lighthearted ones is titled The Happy Wives of Tall Men. And there was some research done in Indonesia by some South Korean researchers showing that if a man is 4 inches taller than his wife, she is 4% happier on a general survey of happiness. And a lot of people immediately assume that that has to do with penis size. The researchers, the researchers did not come to that fairly obvious conclusion. And I think the researchers were right. They looked at it from an evolutionary perspective and they said, look, women want men who can protect their children. And so if they're larger, they feel more at peace generally about the safety of their children. And I think that's probably easily as much to do with their happiness as penis size. There's also a hypothesis called the sexy son hypothesis, which is that mothers favor tall men because they want tall sons, because they were attracted partly because of penis size, but partly because of the guy's protection abilities. And if their sons are tall, they will have the same mating advantages. And as human animals, women are concerned with seeing their genes passed on from generation to generation. So they want their children to survive, but they want grandchildren as well. Another one of my favorite essays in this book, and I think it's called Was It Good for You Too?
Ooh.
Because you can ask your girlfriend, was it good for you too? Your orgasm is going to be a whole lot more obvious than hers, right? If, you know, if she's quiet about it or she's capable of faking it. The thing is that not all women know when they are sexually excited. So they got, it was a study in which they got women to come into the lab and be strapped up with electrodes that would monitor things like heart rate and, you know, electrical excitation. And to a shocking extent, women were unaware of the fact that they were sexually excited. And so what is the survival function of that? Well, if you think back to the idea that primates, orangutans and gorillas, and even chimps, I don't think bonobos do this, the male will kill the child that he's not related to. You want your children to remain in the protection of their father. You have chosen the strongest and hardiest father you could find, and you want him to maintain his investment in his children. If you leave him and bring him to another primate, another dad, that dad might kill them. So that may be the reason that women are not biologically able to recognize when their body is responding to the sight of a gorgeous man.
That is really interesting, very interesting. It's always very protective, I guess, self-protective.
Right.
You're thinking.
Yeah, I actually buy these arguments. I think the fact that we have 45 million years of primate heritage behind us really does mean that we have urges and instincts that we're not aware of consciously, but that govern much of our behavior. Now, you know, there's the whole nature-nurture argument. Not everything that we do is biologically programmed. We also grow up in societies with families. Some people are mean to us. Some of us have traumatic experiences that we're trying to compensate for. But we have these huge biological drives that we can't see, but that govern how we behave sexually.
Mm-hmm. That's true. And whether we like it or not, it's there. So it's like, it brings more validity to when you think of Freud. Initially, he says, you know, civilization are the rules we need to have to contain or suppress our like animal instincts. And, I kind of don't want it or understand it completely to be that way, but there is a purpose for society. Like, it seems to control the selfishness. Maybe that's the word. I feel like society does encourage us to be cooperative.
Yeah, it does encourage us to live more happily in these crowded spaces. Religion does the same thing. My father insisted that we be raised Catholic, and I never saw a lot of religious impulse in him, but he explained to me when I was a teenager, you just need it in order to live in a civilized world. You have to just have faith in the rules and obey them, where there's chaos. And, you know, right. I don't buy that explanation either, but I thought it was very interesting that this supremely intelligent man was able to just choose a belief system because he thought he needed one. And he thought we needed one.
Yeah. I've definitely, I mean, I don't have a religion, but I did send my daughter to Sunday school for a while when she was young, because I felt like I wanted her to, I guess, know what, you know, what's the mainstream religion where we live. And I wanted, and everyone else in my family had a Christian background. So I was like, well, right. I wanted to expose it to her. And so that she can, and then she can later decide, you know, what she wants to do. Like, I didn't force her to make any decisions. But I did put her in the environment that I was raised in. Kind of as, I hate to say it, kind of like a safety. Well, at least, you know, she had something.
Right.
Because I, you know, and I don't think she really would have needed that in order to be a moral human being. But part of me in the back of my head kind of felt like it was like some sort of backup.
Yeah, an insurance plan.
And I also thought, you know, for some people, they might want religion. It might provide a source of strength or faith at a time where she needs something greater than herself, if she ever felt like it. I just felt like I should expose her to different beliefs, you know.
And so did you then also expose her to other beliefs? Like, did you take her to a Buddhist temple or to a meeting of the Ethical Culture Society?
You know what? That was the intention, but I'm lazy. Her dad was like, hey, let's take her to a Buddhist temple. And I was like, okay. And then we never did it because we don't really have any strong spiritual beliefs ourselves.
Yeah.
So I think that made us kind of lazy. Like, oh, well, she'll, but she's 12. I still have time.
Right.
It's not over. But that was definitely what came to mind. And like, hey, well, she should have some other, you know, some other images and or concepts to look at if she's going to explore, you know, her spirituality. That's what
right.
we think.
And certainly if she went to college and was a humanities major, she would be exposed to ideas like that.
Yeah, that's a good thing about college. I definitely feel like that's your, I felt like that's when I finally got some real education was when I went to college.
Right.
Everything else was a blur.
Yes. And I went to a college where they didn't, you chose a major and you had mandatory courses to take within those majors. But aside from that, there were no requirements whatsoever. You got to study whatever you wanted. If you wanted to take pottery for another 120 credits or whatever, you could do that. And what in fact happened was that given absolute freedom about what they could study, everybody I knew studied everything as hard as they could because they had gotten to choose it. We had a very, very difficult, you know, that it was tough to get an A from a woman named Rita Madsen. She was an English teacher, but she taught brilliantly. And she taught, you know, Shakespeare, and she taught comedy, and she taught, I don't remember, Chaucer, a variety of really tough classes that you had to sign up for early to even get into. She was that popular, though nobody had to be there. And people would congregate in the hall outside of her class just to listen in.
I never had a professor like that. That would have been great.
Yeah, we had a whole bunch of them. We had a whole bunch of them. And they just said, go study what you want.
What college did she go to? Or what college was this?
Well, now it's called Webster University. And I don't believe it has the same attitude. I was there signing books once when I'd come out with a novel that was a it was a fact-based novel about Sigmund Freud and his daughter. It's called Hysterical, Anna Freud's story, because she's gay, or she was gay. And he taught that while homosexuality in men was a perfectly understandable thing, they shouldn't do too much of it because it takes them away from their families and their role as humans is to procreate. homosexuality among women will drive you crazy. And the reason that it would drive you crazy is that only men have moral compasses, because we're evolved from apes, and men have a racial memory of being castrated by their fathers for misbehavior. That's the castration complex. So the castration complex gives them a moral sense. Women don't have a castration complex because they never had penises. So women lie and cheat and manipulate to get men to give them penis substitutes, which are babies. Wow. So if you are a lesbian, you don't want one of those men, and you are entirely unguided through life. And so Sigmund Freud realized that his daughter was gay and thought, holy cow, I've got to stop that. And so he did conversion therapy to her.
Aww.
And he diagnosed her as hysterical, because any sort of lesbianism he diagnosed as hysterical. And then he tried to cure her of it. And that was really crazy making, because, as he said, psychoanalysis is an erotic practice. You have to fall in love with each other. So he did the worst possible thing to his daughter. And she emerged from it and ran off with another woman and stayed with her for 54 years.
Good for her.
Yeah. Now, I can't even remember why I started on that long story. What had you just said?
What did I say? Oh, we were just talking about the college, and we were just talking about some of the...
Oh, right. So I was at the college signing books, right? I did a major book tour for this. And I was at the college signing books. And, you know, my memories of this college where I was allowed to study anything I wanted are so wonderful. But it was, 1,200 people on campus, a total of 5 buildings. Now it's a sprawling campus with a football team and a stadium.
Oh, wow.
And this kid comes up and he's talking to me and asks me to sign my book. And I say, so what's your major? And I'm thinking he's going to respond, philosophy, math, any of the hard science, any of the humanities, any of the arts. And he says, public relations. And I said, oh, shoot me. Like, how did this happen here?
Yeah, like, you guys sold out.
Yeah.
But...
it changed. You know, it just changed. It had to change to stay alive.
Yeah, everything changes. And I'm always like, I say I love change, but that's because I have to go with it and I try to be optimist.
Right.
Because change is inevitable. So.
Right. And as Stephen Jobs said when he was dying, that he loved change and that death is life's big change agent. Mm-hmm. But it's a good thing. And yeah, I think change is good.
It is. It is. And I don't see death as a bad thing. I feel like it's just a part of life. You know, it's just what it is. It's the big elephant in the room that we avoid talking or thinking about at all times. I asked you, so we have this portion of the show where you do the intro to your show. So you'll say your name and that you're on the Dope Science Show, and you'll try to encourage the listener to listen in. So, for example, you would say, well, or at least what I would say is, hey, I'm Stephanie, a.k.a. Science Stuff with Steph, and I'm on the Dope Science Show, and you guys better listen in because you don't want to miss out. So you could say something like that, whatever your version of that is.
Okay. You want me to say that now?
Yeah, and you can say it as many times as you feel like it, and then I'll edit it and put it in the beginning of the show.
So, hi, everybody. My name's Rebecca Coffey. I'm a science journalist. I'm also a humorist and a novelist. And I'm on Stephanie's Dope Science Show, talking real science and real lust. And the name of the book is Science and Lust.
You're a pro. That was perfect.
Thank you.
Very good. Very good.
Thank you guys so much for listening. I want to recommend that you go to scienceandless.com and check out Rebecca Coffey's book. It's great. It's entertaining. It's insightful. You'll be the cool person in the room with all the ape and man sexuality facts. And you should check out Bonobos. Look them up. They're very, very interesting. My obsession will not end, so you will be hearing more about them. And I have a new thing. If you guys are listening on the Anchor app, you will hear Rebecca's choice of music. It is John Mraz, I'm Yours. And or if you're listening on Spotify, you can listen to the whole song as well. Otherwise, check it out on YouTube. And thank you guys for listening. I'll talk to you soon. Have a great week. Peace.